permit me to say a few words just in front of you.
You're the rabbi.
All right, I think we've all now settled in. Wonderful to see everyone tonight for this second lecture of Rabbi Wexler's. We're looking forward to gaining a little bit more connectivity to our prayer language. Definition of kavanah in prayer is to have havanat hamilim, the understanding of words, one definition of intentionality in prayer, and invite you just on that level to enjoy tonight, plus to have this understanding we're going to gain, I'm sure, is going to uplift us intellectually here in the library, the Beit Midrash, and also help us inform our prayer life as a community. I just want to say on the at the outset, so that Rabbi can end tonight with questions and to wrap up himself, that in terms of our intellectual life at Or Zeruah, I want to make sure everybody has a couple of dates on their calendar, or at least hears from me, that we're expecting, in terms of other scholars in our community, the programming committee has put a scholarly Shabbaton on the schedule this year on March 27th and 28th, where we're welcoming the directors of Jewish studies from Muhlenberg College and Lehigh University, Professors Jessica Cooperman and Hartley Lachter. And we would like a very, very wonderful turnout just like this for the Friday night dinner that we'll have and the Saturday lecture, the Yom Shabbat lecture. And so please, March 27, 28, and then we'll have a talk on the Passover Haggadah with Dr. Josh Culp, who's the Rosh Yeshiva at Conservative Yeshiva in April on the 1st. Just to say that look out for the other scholarly engagements we have and put them on the calendar early, because we're weeks away yet from the next newsletter. But back to tonight's talk. Wednesday night, the 1st of April for the Haggadah. So I want to again thank publicly Rabbi Wexler for preparing these two lectures for us, as he's here in New York to come enjoy his time as part of the community and in New York City. And here we make him, or we invite him, of course, to do the wonderful, wonderful blessing of teaching us Morenu v'Rabbeinu, Kavod HaRav Wexler.
Thank you very much, Bolton, again, for the lovely introduction. We're here another 2 weeks. Everybody asks me, whenever I see them, when are you going back? So the answer is 2 weeks. 2 weeks from tomorrow, we go back. And please God, we'll be there. We're going back partly to vote in another election. Far too many, as far as I can see, but not one of them has been successful so far. So try again. We'll try again, see what happens. So it's a real pleasure to be able to teach while Naomi and I are here. Among other things, I'm always working on something. At least in my head, I'm working on something. Once I retired so that Rabbi Bolton could lead the congregation, but not so that I could go out the pasture. And it was an opportunity to be able to just keep going, and doing things that I really set in motion through the many years that I was here in Or Zeruah. Those of you who were in my Talmud class will remember that 1 year we studied Masechet Chagiga, and we studied a number of years, we studied the entire Masechet Brachot, and all of that you will see, if you remember it, is worked into some of the things that you may be hearing tonight. Okay? There's a handout. So if you have the handout, I'm not going to deal a great deal with the handout, but it might be useful to you as we get to the material, because I'll be quoting certain things. It's just from the prayer book. This is the first part of the morning service, of the Shacharit service, first part after the Baruch Hu, and that's what I have xeroxed here from the Koran Sidur, so that you have access to both the Hebrew and the English to the extent that it will come up in the lecture. Okay? The title of this lecture is Cosmological Metaphors in the Siddur. When I announced that, I was forewarned that nobody might come tonight. The fact that you have shown up is either an indication of your intelligence, which I'm sure it is.
Oh, you don't know what the word means.
Or you're just kind of, you're curious to figure out what in the world could this guy be talking about. Okay? Cosmological metaphors in the Siddur. Hopefully by the end of the lecture it will make sense. This essay is an effort to understand the small but significant section of the morning prayers recited after Baruch Hu. A section that praises God.
Rabbi, could you speak a little louder, please?
I could try, but I might not succeed. Okay? Well, let me stand up. That will probably help things. Since I'm reading from a text, if I stand up, I think that will probably broadcast a little bit better. I'll start again. If you have a stender, that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
Where's the stender?
It's over here.
Okay. Oh, that's it. That's a top-to-bottom stender. Okay.
Art. Would it help? Come sit. Arthur,
Rabbi wants to know if you want to sit closer.
Art.
Yes.
Well, why not?
Okay. He reserved you a seat. Go around. Or around anyway. You can come this way. There is a chair. There's a chair over there.
Age has its privileges.
Absolutely. No doubt about it. Okay. I shall begin again. Okay? Took a time around. This essay is an effort to understand a small but significant section of the morning prayers recited after the Baruch Hu that praises God as creator of the lights and which contains two ecstatic visions. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, and blessed be the Lord's glory from his place. Okay? So I'm saying it in English. It almost sounds very religious in English. Sometimes when you say it in Hebrew, you always say it, so you don't pay attention to it. So I am saying it in English. And each of those ecstatic phrases is, according to the text, recited by angels. This section is one that speaks a lot about music. It is this vision, a vision of angels who are singing, that is my text. Who are they, these angels? What are they doing there? What is the music? And why is this the way that we praise the Lord of creation? To answer these questions, I need to take you on a tour, not only of the prayers themselves, but of other literature, and I hope you'll enjoy the ride. In addition to our prayer book, we will visit 17th and 19th century England, 5th century BCE Greece, and the first pre-Christian century Rome, all the while taking that tour in order to come home to the prayer book which was set down in its basic form in early Talmudic times. Come with me first to Stratford-on-Avon, to the familiar haunts of William Shakespeare. In the second act of his Romeo and Juliet, Romeo is found hiding in the Capulet orchards. Not a great place to be at that point, but it was good for the following reason. Juliet was leaning out of a high window. That was good enough reason to be there. It was dangerous, but worthwhile taking one's life at risk. Though it is late at night, Juliet's great beauty causes Romeo to say the following. Quote, "It is the east, and Juliet is the sun. Arise, fair sun, and kill the envious moon, who is already sick and pale with grief that thou, her maid, art far more fair than she." Romeo, you see, in his loving ecstasy, speaks of Juliet as the sun. Now, is she really the sun? Of course not. But to him, she turns the night into day, just as the sun does for the rest of us. Speaking of Juliet as the sun is speaking in metaphors. And Shakespeare, we know, is very good at that. As well, we know what Romeo is getting at. Shakespeare, like you and me, know what it is for the sun to rise, and we know what it is for the sun to reveal its warmth and its beauty. We also know that everything on earth grows because of the sun. To call Juliet the sun brings to mind overcoming darkness, creating life, and warmth, and probably a dozen other things. This is a metaphor well used. Shakespeare can use it because the sun speaks to our experience. I know what he's getting at when he says, Romeo, that Juliet is the sun. Shakespeare knew that, and he took advantage of the fact. Now let me give you another example, an example closer to home, closer to us, and yet an example that is much more distant from us. It is the language in the prayer book, the language we recite 7 days a week that speaks about the rising of the sun. After the Baruch Hu, the prayer book recites a paean of praise to God who is the creator of the light. All of this is a reaction to the personal perception of waking up and of realizing that the day has dawned. And all of that is because there is a sun. Quote, "The Lord creates light and darkness. He makes peace and creates everything in compassion. He gives light to the earth and its inhabitants, and in his goodness continually renews the work of the creation, day after day. How numerous are your works, O Lord! You made them all in wisdom. The earth is full of your creations." If you read during the davening, if you read the English side of a page, that's what you're reading. The prayer goes on in this vein, and then begins to pick up steam with flowery and excited language. Listen to this. "The blessed gods, great in knowledge, prepared and made the rays of the sun. He who is good formed glory for his name." Get that to the English. Glory. Kavod lishmo. Glory for his name. When's the last time you used that word glory? "Surrounding his power with radiant stars, the pinot of his hosts," usually translated as the captains or the leaders of his hosts, which I don't think is what it means, by the way. I think it means the corners of his hosts. And I'll get to that perhaps later. The holy ones exalt the Almighty, constantly proclaiming God's glory and holiness. Be blessed, Lord our God, for the magnificence of your handiwork and for the radiant lights you have made. May they glorify you, Selah. Trumpets should come at the end of that, okay? In the old days, or in those places where they had an organ, the organ would go, that's what it deserves, okay? Now, the going gets even better. God creates, the prayer book says, ministering angels, holy beings, who stand in the heights of the universe, proclaiming together in awe aloud the words of the living God, the eternal King. Who are these angels? Why are they there? They are, again quote, beloved, pure, almighty, and they do God's will. They open their mouths in holiness and purity. With song and psalm they revere, praise, glorify, sanctify, and declare the sovereignty of the name of the great, mighty, and awesome God and King. Holy is He. All accept upon themselves one from another. Still talking about the angels. The yoke of the kingdom of heaven, granting permission to one another to sanctify the one who formed them. In serene spirit, pure speech, and sweet melody. It's gorgeous, just gorgeous. Imagine this. All is one, proclaim his holiness, saying, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole world is filled with his glory. Look, you're just reciting it. It's really it's incredible stuff. Incredible. I don't know what it means, but it's incredible. It sounds very good. It sounds very good. And that's not the end. Rather, it's just the beginning. Because then, the chayot, another kind of angel, God knows what the chayot are, because they're animal angels, with a roar of noise, raise themselves to the seraphim. Who are they? Another bunch of angels. Okay? And facing them, give praise, saying, blessed be the Lord's glory from his place. That's just wonderful. It's great. Let's take it over here. What we have seen is the introduction of angels into our prayers. And I wonder if you don't find that odd. Do I believe in angels? Francie, you talked on this one. You remember one of those people? You gave a talk on angels. And who are these angels anyway? What do they have to do with the sun? My thesis is that the prayer book is speaking in metaphoric language. Back to the metaphors. And perhaps when it says angels, it doesn't really mean the angels that I think about. Not those creatures with wings that I know from the paintings. You know, when I say the word angel, what does it mean to you? What's on the back of an angel? Why? Is it because some Christians in the 12th century decided that it should be? Once, Naomi and I had this wonderful experience. We went to visit Pompeii. Any of you been to Pompeii?
Yeah.
We went to these houses in Pompeii to see, I don't know, how people live. Pompeii is a preserved city because Vesuvius decided to explode. This was just, when was it, 76? Of the Christian era or so. And it was right after the destruction of the temple, and therefore we read that the rabbis, the Roman rabbis, said at that point, well, of course, you destroyed the temple, you got what you deserve. So that's midah and neged midah, right? So measure for measure, as it were. So we talked about last week. So we go into one of these houses, And this is Rome. This is Vesuvius. It's outside of Naples. And this is all pre-Christian. There's no such thing as Christianity yet. Christianity is yet 150 years down the road till you really have any Christianity. And so at this point, we walk into one of these houses, and guess what we saw? Angels! Fresco of angels, which I took a picture of. I'm sure I can't find it anymore, but we took a picture of these angels. And obviously, that image of angels with wings is not, as I always thought, from the Christian Middle Ages, but it's pre-Christian. It must go back into antiquity. And this I learned we learned this from looking into a house in the city of Vesuvius, in the neighborhood of Vesuvius. What are they doing in the prayer book? What are they trying to convey? Perhaps when it says angels, it doesn't mean those creatures. It's hinting in some mysterious way about the sun. But how? What do these angels have to do with the sun? What do they have to do with God? Let me put it to you like this. When Shakespeare spoke of Juliet as the sun, I understood what he was getting at because I could relate to it. All right? I knew how to interpret the metaphor. But when the prayer book speaks of angels, I suspect the prayer book is speaking metaphorically, but honestly, I can't relate to it because I don't know what it's talking about. I just don't know what's behind it. I don't have an experience with angels. Except for the places where they appear in the Torah and are clearly messengers, I don't have any idea what they are. That's my problem. And that's the problem that I have come to solve. Now, we really have three options in front of us. First, it may be that these angels do exist. Some sort of creatures with wings, or however they exist. They're flying around. Well, I don't know what they are. Something. And that we can't really connect to them. That's my problem. This is not without a scriptural basis. For example, in the apocryphal books of Enoch, there is a detailed description of the angels. How they live, what they do. Well, you will probably say to yourself, that kind of stuff is either for neurotics or mystics. Okay? You could be crazy enough to believe that. Crazy people can believe in anything. Or mystics. But maybe, and that's what it is in the book of Enoch, in the Apocrypha, you're talking about mystical experience, and mystics speak in all kinds of images that are hard to understand, but that's what it is to be a mystic. To have a certain extraterrestrial experience, and God knows what it is. If you're a mystic, you know it. Therefore, as a solution to my problem, though, and if someone, while mystically inclined, isn't willing to argue that you have to be a mystic to be religious, this first proposed solution is not so good. These are prayers for you and me, and at least I am not such a big mystic. The next option is the opposite. Very simply put, this is all ridiculous. Nobody living in this modern world who is in his right mind counts the number of angels on the head of a pin. Nor should he be spending his daylight waking hours focusing on things that angels do. Like, for example, singing the Lord's praises, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. Well, as you might imagine, I'm not a big fan of this option. Because that means that the prayer book has to be thrown away. It's not saying anything that speaks to me. Third option is that I assume that the language of the Siddur is poetry, that it's probably written by a very good poet, and that if I don't understand it, it's my problem. enter the metaphor, the option I like. Whereas I understood what Shakespeare was getting at when Romeo called Juliet the sun, I need some interpretive framework to enable me to understand what it means for angels to sing. And I think it's possible to find that framework, but it's not easy. That's because I am convinced that the rabbis who wrote the prayer book not only were conversant in metaphoric language, but that they used that language drawing it from a certain context. And that is what I have called cosmology. Cosmology. What is cosmology? In Greek, the word means order. The cosmos is the order of all things. Seder, a seder, seder ha'olam. But it is more than that. To the Greeks, this order is aesthetically pleasing as a result of its careful arrangement. It is a view of the universe that changes over time as observations based on the state of science also change over time. That there was an ancient view of the cosmos may seem strange because we moderns are in the habit of assuming that ancient people didn't really think scientifically because they didn't have access to modern science. But that's a big mistake. They saw the universe. They described it. They had theories about it. And they wrote them down. The more I read rabbinic literature, the clearer it is to me that the thinking of the rabbis took place in the context of Hellenistic civilization. And that includes Hellenistic ideas of the cosmos. That civilization was heavily influenced by Greek thinkers, who in turn influenced Roman thinkers. And the way they saw the world, that way just got into the air. It was part of the culture. It was something that people breathed if you lived in that world. How often do you and I think about just the culture we live in, how it penetrates us? We need a sociologist once in a while to say, don't you realize why you're doing this? But the truth is, that's what culture is. And our rabbis lived in a Hellenistic world, both in the Greek Hellenistic world and in the Roman world that eventually succeeded that Greek world. My teacher, the late Professor Lieberman, showed clearly and conclusively that there was, as the title of his book says it, Hellenism in Jewish Palestine. And since Lieberman's research, that has become an accepted way of looking at things. Even take the Hebrew word olam. Hebrew word olam, which we would translate as world, or universe, or eternity. Professor Matt Skadushin in his book, The Rabbinic Mind, showed that the word olam is closest to the Greek word for cosmos. Olam is the cosmos. Now, just think of it. You and I use different words for the word for world and for cosmos. If I say to you the world is in bad shape, you know what I mean. If I say the cosmos is in bad shape, that's a real problem. Okay? That's what you call a cosmic problem. Right? A cosmic problem. That's very serious. Olam means cosmos. We're reading rabbinic Hebrew. If you see the word olam, don't only translate it as world or as eternity. Well, eternity is the cosmos is also eternal, realize, according to the Greeks. According to Aristotle, the cosmos is eternal. And that's why it means eternity, I'm sure, in Hebrew as well. Well, maybe why it means that in Hebrew. Cosmos to us is something more abstract, more complete, less limited than the word world. That was, in many contexts, the olam of the rabbis, their cosmos. The rabbinic literature contains several comments about the makeup of that cosmos. In the Tractate of Chagiga, for example, page 12b, Rish Lakish says that there are seven heavens. Okay, this is rabbinic astronomy in a way. There are seven heavens. Those heavens are spoken of as wheels or spheres, galgalim in Hebrew. But we don't know if it means wheels or spheres. Could be either one. Though not all the rabbis agreed with Rish Lakish, the image of seven heavens continues to persist even to our own day. You hear that as a phrase, seven heavens. Seventh heaven. I'm in seventh heaven. What does that mean? You're very high, right? You're very happy. You're in seventh heaven. Among the Greeks, the cosmos consisted of the earth as a globe surrounded by a system of rotating spheres and circles. Okay, try to picture this. Cosmos, the earth is a globe. Interesting. I learned when I was in elementary school that Columbus discovered that the world was round. The only problem with that is that the Greeks discovered it 2,000 years before. So that was known by Greek scientists. Okay? Plato, Aristotle, and the Stoics. And the great astronomer of the 2nd century CE, Ptolemy of Alexandria, all embraced this theory in one form or another, that the earth is a globe surrounded by a system of rotating spheres and circles. This was the model that was widely accepted in the Roman world. In its Ptolemaic form, the geocentric sphere-based conception of the universe remained dominant in the West until the late Renaissance. Realize that. Relatively recently, till you had people who came on the scene like Galileo, Kepler, and others. Rish Lakish's description of seven heavens has in fact no basis in Scripture, and he doesn't try to anchor it in Scripture. It does, however, reflect the same number as found in the Greek cosmology, even though its details differ. Note especially that in Rish Lakish's description of the seven heavens, in the second one up from the bottom, you will find all of the heavenly bodies, the sun, the moon, and the five visible planets. So they knew all about those things. They could see with the naked eye five planets. They located it then in this cosmological order of the spheres, of these rotating spheres that were above the earth. Though it is a product of a much later time, Maimonides summarizes and expands upon Aristotle's views of the cosmos. He does this both in the Sefer Amada, that is part of his Mishneh Torah, and in the Moreh Nevuchim, in his Guide for the Perplexed. I've taken a quote from the Ilchot Yesodei HaTorah, chapter 3, which is from the Mishneh Torah. He describes these galgalim, wheels or spheres, coming up with a different number than does Rish Lakish. They are spheres within spheres, and while the spheres themselves are colorless, they appear to be blue, he says, because of the refraction of the high air. Interestingly, he writes that they have no taste or smell, these spheres, because things like taste and smell occur only in our world. In our world. In the ninth halacha, Maimonides says the following. All the stars in the spheres, get this now, listen to this, have a soul and a mind and intelligence. I'll read that again. All the stars in the spheres have a soul and a mind and an intelligence. They are alive and recognize he who created the world. Each to his greatness and level praise and glorify their creator just as the angels do. Getting hot now. Coming back. And as they recognize the Holy One, blessed be He, so do they recognize the angels who are above them. the intelligence of the stars and the spheres is less, he notes, than the intelligence of the angels. Yet it is greater than the intelligence of human beings. Look at this picture, and he's got several different levels in this cosmological framework. Angels are somewhere up there. Lower than that, you have the stars and the planets. And down at the bottom, you have us. You have us. And as you get higher, and this is classic Maimonides, as you get higher and higher, you get more divine. You get more divine. Now, don't think that these angels or these spheres are anything like the things we know about, or that the angels have forms that you could recognize. Maimonides makes it very clear in the Guide for the Perplexed that the angels have no form, no form whatsoever. How do we understand it then? Mystery. But this is all part of the cosmological framework that he has derived from Aristotle. Okay? This is his effort to derive a cosmological framework that fits with the Torah as he understood it, that's based on the scientific ideas of Aristotle. Now, they are intelligent. Imagine that. How could they be intelligent? How could they think? How could they be wise? Almost seems ridiculous to the modern mind. Our modern view of science is basically static. The ancient view of the cosmos, however, was that the cosmos was alive. It was alive. In Aristotle, as in Maimonides, things that move have a soul. It's very important idea in Aristotle. Things that move have a soul. Okay? And everything that moves, by definition, has a soul, but things are different depending upon what their essential movement is. For example, the essential movement of the human being is the movement of our minds. And therefore, for Maimonides, the mind is what makes the human being human. Right? A dog will move in a certain way, and therefore it's alive, and it's a dog. Okay? Everything that moves has a soul of some kind. And if it moves with order, not only does it have a soul, but it is intelligent. The definition of intelligence is that it is filled with order. And therefore, the cosmos is filled with order because people looked and they saw that there was a repetitive order. It always was the same. It moved in the same direction. And it was the same year after year if you observed it carefully. And therefore, by definition, it was intelligence. It was filled with order. So intelligence doesn't mean what it means to you and me. They had a different use of the terminology. That's why I'm underlining this. They were aware of how sophisticated the movements of the cosmos were. They knew, on the basis of observation, that things were created with great design. They didn't only, after all, occasionally look up at the stars and the sun and the moon. They had no electricity. They had no lights. And to them, the night was very real. They were in close touch with the universe. Frankly, probably much closer touch than you or I. They knew the constellations. The constellations played a part in their lives. They described them in detail, far more than most of us can do. Do not think that they lived with the illusion that the constellations were alive as we are alive in this world of ours, but they did believe that the universe was alive on its own terms, in its own way, as a result of its constant, thoughtful, steady movement. And that was all the proof they needed. Steady, thoughtful movement. As a matter of fact, that's all the proof you do need. It's a different way of seeing the cosmos. And I would like to submit to you, maybe not such a bad way. I know you may be thinking that it's not accurate, it's not scientific. Is that right? Then the universe, the cosmos, conveyed design, thoughtfulness, and beauty. Just think to yourselves, shouldn't it convey that to us? And as part of the cosmos, there was a level of reality and intelligence called angels. In a fascinating study by Professor Jeremy Penner called Patterns of Daily Prayer in Second Temple Judaism, Penner suggests the following, that in the ancient world, the regularity of the heavenly cycles was the surest proof that divine beings existed. In a section entitled The Influence of Cosmology on Prayer, Penner notes that the pagan idea that the stars were gods and would naturally be addressed at night in Israel was condemned. We reject it. The Bible rejects the idea that there are astral or star gods. There's a pagan idea. Biblical books such as Jeremiah, Deuteronomy, Leviticus, reforms of Josiah targeted these astral practices. The Penner goes on to summarize the morning and evening prayer as follows. Morning prayer is linked to the praise of God's glory in creation and the renewal of creation that occurs with every sunrise. Evening prayer is linked to the praise of God's glory in the heavenly temple. Those praying on earth take their cue from the appearance of astronomical phenomena, the sun in the morning, the moon and the stars in the evening. The congregation on earth assumes an angelic counterpart to be praying with them. The angels, he writes, are understood to coalesce with the stars in the heavens and their movements. What I want to suggest to you is that the angels are, as a metaphor, an embodiment of the spheres above the earth. When you are reading in the prayers about the angels, you are reading about the magnificence of the sky and everything that is happening in it. And all of that is put into the metaphoric mouth of the angels. They're there. They're not completely identified with each of the spheres, but they occupy the same space, the angels. And they are different levels of the same reality, and they participate together in divine praise. So look where we are now. Cosmos is both an objective reality described in static terms, and it is a living reality described in ancient cosmic terms. Its order, its movement, its intelligence are all awesome. That was the thinking 2,000 years ago. Though our science has changed, the daily prayers are there to remind us that a description of the heavens that leaves it lifeless is insufficient. William Blake, the English poet who wrote in the early part of the 19th century, lived in a world where science had begun to empty the cosmos of its mystery and beauty. In his poem entitled Vision of Last Judgment, Blake writes, "What It will be questioned. When the sun rises, do you not see a round disk of fire, somewhat like a guinea? He's talking about the scientists in his times, or the regular people who are subject to this view of the world. You look up and you see this, and what do you see? It looks like a guinea. It's a round thing, like a coin. It's just like a coin. Okay, that's what you see. Oh no, he goes on. Oh no, no. I see an innumerable company of the heavenly host crying, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. This is William Blake. A Christian. Okay? Blake understood the cosmic metaphors of our prayers, though I assume he didn't know them. Can look and describe the sun and think that you have dealt with reality when you've described it as a circle, just like a guinea. To him and to me, that would be a modern sickness. On the one hand, the description is right, but you have to be able to have the capacity, with science and with its descriptions of the universe, whatever they are today and whatever they will be tomorrow, you need to see that the most important reaction to all of the phenomena is wonder. And the words of wonder today are what they were to Blake and what they were 2,000 years ago. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. Now there remains one other issue to address. That is the importance of music in these prayers of the morning service. First of all, the angels are singing. They're not just reciting things, they're singing. On the one hand, there is substantial evidence that this is an idea found in the Apocrypha, the third book of Enoch, that is what angels do. They sing. But that's not enough. If the angels are part of the cosmos, and if the angels sing, then the cosmos sings. I didn't make this up. It is an ancient Greek idea, first popularized by the Pythagoreans, that there is a music of the spheres. It's a beautiful phrase, by the way, in English too. Music of the spheres. Their thinking is based on the observation that when things move, they naturally create sound. Right? It's a terrific observation, because what is music? It takes a moving string or a moving column of air to create music. Everything that moves creates sound. And since the movement of the heavens, they said, are the largest movements we can imagine, they must create extremely loud sounds. It's very logical, no? But since there is a beauty and an order to the cosmos, the sounds, too, must be beautiful and orderly. From this beginning, the Pythagoreans theorized that our musical scales and harmonies that are pleasing to us reflect the music of the spheres. Plato, in the 10th chapter of the Republic, describes the universe as made up of 8 concentric circles. Okay, you had Rish Lakish had 7. Plato has 8 in the Republic, the way he described. Basically the same system, slightly different. They're three-dimensional, much like cups, and they're all moving, says Plato. On top of each of its circles stood a siren revolving around with it, producing a single sound on one note. And from all 8 of them, the sounds blended into a single harmony. That's Plato Republic, the 10th section. 3 fates dressed in white garments with garlands on their heads sing in response to the harmony of the sirens. A little later on, several hundred years, actually. The Roman orator, statesman, and philosopher Cicero also wrote a book that he called The Republic. It was his republic. And in his republic, Cicero describes the universe similarly. In a section called The Dream of Scipio, he describes nine orbs or globes by which all things are held together. Okay, Resh Lakish had seven, Plato had eight, and here Cicero has nine. The orbs contain the stars and the planets, and their motion produces music. Quote, "What is this sound so strong and so sweet that fills my ears?" he says. "This is the melody which, at intervals unequal, yet differing in exact proportions, is made by the impulse and motion of the spheres themselves, which, softening shriller by deeper tones, produce a diversity of regular harmonies." That's all Cicero. To Cicero, the music of the spheres is a model to be copied by human composers. A quote from Cicero, "Skilled men copying the harmony with strings and voices have opened for themselves a way back to this place." Unquote. But he notes that the music, if you think about it, you have loud music from these huge spheres. It's deafening. And also, why aren't we all able to hear it? Okay, have you thought about it? Very nice, it's a good idea. But are you hearing it? Right? We're not hearing it. Cicero notes that the music is deafening. And here I quote again from Cicero. "As where the Nile at the falls of Catadupa pours down from the loftiest mountains, the people who live nearby lack the sense of hearing because of the loudness of the cataract. So this harmony of the whole universe in its intense, rapid movement is so loud that men's ears cannot take it in. We're dulled to the sound, and that's why you and I are not hearing it. Only people with a special musical ability are able to listen to the sound of the spheres. It's just like you cannot look directly into the sun, and the keenness of the visual power of the eye, all of that is overwhelmed by its rays. So also for the music of the spheres." The morning prayers, get back to our subject, portray this glorious sound. Using imagery from Isaiah and Ezekiel, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, and blessed be the Lord's glory from his place," melody emanates from the angels. Every day, as they join their voices to praise God, the prayer is a response to the light of the day and describes the awesomeness of creation as witnessed by the light of each day. The imagery is of ministering angels proclaiming together in pure and sweet melody, "B'safa brura uveni'ima." Our prayers reflect the music of the spheres. The angels are part of the cosmos. The cosmos is alive, and it is singing in the harmony. Now, I emphasize this, well aware that, of the fact that not all scholars agree with what I have said. For example, a professor from Bar-Ilan writes, "There is no evidence that the rabbis had any understanding of the Pythagorean theory of celestial movements or its implications. Central to the Pythagorean theory is the belief the sounds of the various heavenly bodies are in harmony with each other. There is no trace of such a belief among the rabbis," he writes. No trace? No evidence? Does he daven in the morning? Does he know what it says? They're singing! That's what the angels are doing. They're all singing the Ofanim and the Holy Chayot with a roar of noise, raise themselves toward the seraphim, giving praise and saying, blessed be the Lord's glory from his place. That's a quote from the prayer book. I didn't make that up. The prayers then go on. To the blessed God they offer melodies. To the King, living in eternal God, they say psalms and proclaim praises. To they, in those statements that I took from the prayer book, are the angels. The angels is the cosmos. It's all singing. It's bursting out in song. And our job is to recall that and to sing with them. We are singing just as they are, in order to respond to the harmony of the spheres with our own harmony. I submit that the harmony of the spheres is a central concept in these early morning prayers. That is but another aspect of the Jewish response to the glory of the day, to the dawn, and to all the creation made by God. Now to summarize. Let us summarize where we have gone. I have tried to show you that the first part of the morning prayers reflects a response to nature, to the cosmos. It was both influenced by the common language and concepts of the Hellenistic world, but that is true and genuine as well to the view of the Bible, that there is a God who is the creator of all. The angels are the metaphor for the cosmos in all of its sophistication, its order, its grandeur, and its song. And I began wondering what the metaphors of angels were that we find in the prayers. I want to conclude by saying that metaphor is a way of speaking about wonder. It is a way of reinforcing wonder, and of making certain that we continue to be in awe of the world in which we live. The fact that we now have massive electronic telescopes that can examine the cosmos in a way that is unique to our times in no way diminishes the wonder of what is out there. To my mind, it only increases that wonder. It is a foolish view that sees our ability to describe nature as necessarily emptying it of its beauty, its order, and its mystery. To the contrary, every sunrise, as every sunset, points beyond itself. That is our way of reacting to living in the world. Its wonder shouts the glory of God. Our observations of it increase our sense of harmony. We say, Oseh Shalom Bimramav. He makes harmony up above. That's what we're talking about. For there is a harmony of the spheres. We are reminded of it every day. When Romeo saw Juliet, he saw the sun. When a Jew sees the sun, he sees the angels singing and giving praises to God. Romeo's lesson was about love. The Jew's lesson is about wonder and living in a universe that is greater than any one of us and that none of our minds can truly grasp. We are left with the option of doing only one thing. And that is to sing. Thank you. Happy to entertain any questions. You're daring. It's a pleasure. Hey, go ahead.
So much of what you speak about is awesome, but it has to do with music and sound. And so, in fact, there's a composer, I can't remember his name, who wrote a piece West. North of the West, but decades ago, where piano player would go on the stage of an auditorium, open the keyboard, and sit there.
John Cage, right.
And just sit there, and the sounds in the concert hall was all you would hear. And so you're reminding us that, and of course sound is vibration, and light is vibration. Light moves much faster than sound because they're faster vibrations. So it just seems to me that everything you're speaking about is this range of vibration.
Agreed. Personally, I prefer Beethoven to John Cage.
I would guess that.
I found that image of the restaurant
in Pompeii.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
And it has wings.
It has wings. Absolutely. That's the thing. It has wings.
It's like a Christian.
Correct. But it's pre-Christian.
This is separate from your...
Right. No, I was going to say, that's your assignment. Okay. Figure it out. Because I'd like to figure it out, too. Please.
Okay, I grew up with a very old version of Hansel and Gretel, you know, where the angels come down and stay around the children while they're sleeping at night. I have the album from, it's 50 or 60 years old. So I always think of angels, you know, but now, and there was music, because the whole album is a music album. But let's talk about all the angels that had some relationship to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Yes. Those are, I refer to in passing just as, those are the ones I can understand. I understand that because they're messengers. They're the easy ones to understand. They somehow, I mean, I can't say I understand them, really, but they somehow are intermediaries between the divine and the human, and they have jobs to do. And God gives them jobs, and they do those jobs. So that's at least one aspect of the angels that is relatively easy to understand. It's this other that I find more complex.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I always imagine the description of the Ark of the Covenant, and you have two seraphim, and they face each other, or away from each other, whichever way, but they have wings. So how much of that has informed the way we think of
I don't know the answer. It's a good question. Very interesting. I really would love to see somebody do a study of the history of angels' wings. Maybe somebody has. Yeah, Google it.
It's
very interesting. You're doing it now. That's very interesting. I don't know too much about it, but it'd be surely interesting to know.
Yeah. Don't they have names? Angel Gabriel,
correct.
Angel. So
correct.
Names
and
are
the names,
given to existing entities.
Right. They're, that's interesting. The angels have names, and they get their names when they have a job. Okay. So, for example,
yeah.
Gabriel comes from Gever, strong, strength, Gvura. So there's some, it could be in war, for example, that you call on Gabriel. Or in the nighttime prayers, call upon Gabriel for protection.
Yeah.
Gabriel is a protecting angel. Raphael comes from Rophe. It's the healing angel.
Yeah.
The healing angel. So it's usually, in terms of the language that we have, where they have languages, where they have names, those names are connected with their jobs, which again, I say, is the relatively easier to understand than Maimonides' incorporeal idea of angels.
In one of the Psalms we read every day, 147, there's a line, he, meaning God, numbers all the stars and gives each one
correct.
A name.
Correct.
Which is the idea, I think it's sort of replicating the idea that you're developing, that naming, making it a name is something beyond.
These ideas that I've developed here in relation to just Yoter Rorechoshech, the beginning of the service, the truth is the next step, the next chapter would be the Psalms. It would be taking examples from the Psalms to show that this is actually what the Psalms are doing. The Psalms are reflecting this view of God and of the psalmist and it's filled with song, and it frequently has, as in the morning prayers, it also has the sun and the stars and the moon singing. Right? They're all singing. So it would all follow. Huh?
Rabbi, are you troubled at all by the fact that the way Jews generally have come to pray these prayers doesn't really comport with the themes that you've outlined? That we generally mumble the prayers. We don't grant them that the majesty that you described. On weekday mornings, we certainly don't sing them. I mean, we chant them, but we don't produce the harmony that you've described. Is that troubling to you as a rabbi?
The answer is yes and no. I'll tell you what I mean. It is important, I think, that they be properly done in each in its proper time. And one of the realities of Jewish life is that we have too much to do. And when you're asking people in the morning to go through their davening and then go to work after that, if you're a bunch of retirees, all retirees, it's one thing, you have time, so you can decide that you're going to devote your time to that. If you've got to go to work, you've got to figure out how to do it. So I've done it in many minyanim, and I have my favorites, my most favorites, and my least favorites. The least favorites are awful. They're really awful. They can be very bad because they can go so fast, and they're so inarticulate that there's no way that a person the least of my intelligence can figure out what's going on. I have to just sort of do my own thing and I fall behind. I learned a lot from davening with communities who took this all very seriously. First, I learned that from Heschel. Heschel said, he always said that one of the great blessings of his life was that he grew up among people who took things seriously. And that's what we tried to do in Horace Avila, too. You have to make compromises, but you should take it seriously. It may or it may not mean that you bring aesthetics to it. Ze elivi andehu, last week's, your parsha. It may be that's a forum for aesthetics, but it may not be. I dined once in a minyan of the Breslov of Hasidim in Tzfat. Ezra had taken me, and we went, the two of us, early in the morning. Probably the best minyan I ever went to. I never went to such a good minyan. Because every single word was pronounced slowly. Well, you got to have a lot of time to do that. And you had that time. We lived right across the street from the... What was the name of the Hasidim? In the old city. I mentioned them. It was... Recently, someone had asked me a question about it. It wasn't the Amshanavr. It was a group of Hasidim who are known for praying, for making the words slowly and just saying them slowly. I always, if you notice, when I daven and I read those things, I follow some of the things that I've learned from others, I clap. And I get to Kadosh, 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 I go like that. Because it requires trumpets. And I don't have trumpets, I have not studied that trumpet, but I have my hands. And in certain communities, there's clapping that goes on. That's very common on the breath of Hasidim. So I think that these are all things that we really, I mean, you can't do this in a day or a year or a lifetime. These are serious issues in prayer that hopefully one would be motivated to try and achieve those goals.
I just want to comment on how influenced the rabbis were, why do they have, by the Hellenistic culture. You know, we always think of Hanukkah, for example, as Hellenism is very bad. It's a, you know, but there is this whole philosophy, this whole approach to the cosmos that really was floating around, but it was floating around in a Hellenistic world.
That's certainly how I feel. It was just not to say that we're the same as the Greeks.
No,
but no,
not at all.
It's the language. It's certain ideas about general things like the cosmos, like the earth, that are shared in a culture. And I think this is it's just very true that we are part of it. Even Hanukkah, you bring up a good example. Who was it? Who wrote the book about Hanukkah, the history of Hanukkah? What was his name? He had an office down the hall from me once. I forget his name. Too late. But he wrote a book about the history, that whole story of Hanukkah. And one of the things that he says in his book, and Gershon Cohen agreed with this. Gershon Cohen used to emphasize the same thing.
Gershon Cohen wrote a book called The Blessing of Assimilation.
Cohen took off from this. He says, the holiday of Hanukkah itself is a Hellenistic idea, that you have a celebration for a military battle. But Jews ever do anything like that? I mean, we have a celebration of Pesach. What kind of military battle is that?
Well, it was God's battle.
God is one thing, but not us.
Yeah.
I mean, here you have that's what the Greeks did. And we adapted from them these ideas. And we incorporated them into Judaism so that they are Jewish. Of course, the Hellenism that the rabbis reacted against, there was a level to it which they had reacted against, and they should react against. As we, by the way, this is what they addressed in Cohen, we would have these conversations. There are things that we should assimilate. There are things that we should reject. And that's a hard job, but it's crucial for us. That's our job. We have to know what to assimilate and what to reject. Okay. Anybody else? Hey.
You say that the Greek gods, you know where they were, and they were up, and our religion doesn't localize God anywhere other than on the ark. Because Shekinah is there. That's where he dwells, if you will. So the minute they came to the conclusion that he was sort of somewhere, I always assumed that once that sort of anthropomorphism came into being, that they couldn't imagine him being lonely. So he had to be surrounded, and who would be better than to be surrounded by adoring cherubs? So I think that was sort of the compromise, was getting away from being totally ethereal. And obviously that was a very Greek and Roman idea.
Very nice. Yes.
What you've been talking about tonight, about cosmology and mysticism of the planets, just makes me think of the beautiful piece, The Planets, 20th Century Piece by
Holst.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, I think, frankly, that he must have concentrated on his idea of the harmony of the music of the spheres. Yes. Because he tries to do it himself.
Cosmos means world. In French, when you say about someone, he's cosmopolite. That means he doesn't belong to one world.
He's worldly.
He belongs to many worlds. Many cultures.
Right.
In effect.
That's right. That's very nice. You true in English too. Anne? Yes?
Robert, you mentioned Blake also has holy, holy, holy. I've seen that in Christian prayer books. Straight from us.
Well, it's a little bit different in the Christian prayer book. I'm not here to teach you Christianity, but realize that the Sanctus is the case that's part of the Mass. The Sanctus means holy. Sanctus, Sanctus, Dominus Deus. It's holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. And it's taken from the language of Isaiah. And that is a moment in the Catholic Mass where there's transubstantiation. That's when the blood and the wine and the bread are transformed. So they borrowed it. They borrowed the language, of course, from us, but used it for a very different purpose.
So we assume that this was created when God created the heavens and the earth. When I say the heavens, it is really all of the complexity that you were saying.
The cosmos.
Is there any place that discusses that created day? What was entailed in the heavens?
A lot of places. And the truth is that in commentaries to the first few verses of Genesis, or the first chapter of Genesis, let's say, you get a lot of speculation there. And you can go in the mystical direction. You have mystical speculation on such things. But let's put that to the side. Even non-mystical is a huge amount of literature. Most of it is in the form of commentary. Not all, but most of it is.